Good evening, everybody. We're so glad you're here at the MSU Libraries. Welcome on behalf of the MSU Muslim Studies Program and the MSU Libraries. And we also want to thank our community partners, the Islamic Center of Greater Lansing and the Interfaith Clergy Association of Greater Lansing. And this is our third Muslim Journeys Book Club of this academic year, and we're meeting every 2 weeks now. So 2 weeks from now, we'll be here again reading Ms. Marvel, No Normal, which is a comic book series written by G. Willow Wilson, a Muslim American writer about a Muslim American superhero heroine. So that's going to be really fun, and there's more information about that. And that event is also part of a larger event called the MSU Comics Forum. So if you like comics, there's a whole weekend of lectures and events, which you're invited to, including an exhibit of comics from MSU Library Special Collections. We have a huge comic collection, maybe the largest international comics collection. And speaking of exhibits, the table like behind where Mike is, that in the corner with books on it, those are for you to borrow. They're not just to look at, so feel free to borrow those. Okay, let me tell you a little bit about our format for these Muslim Journeys events. First, we'll have about a half an hour of lecture, and then we're going to break into discussion groups at these tables in the back, and those are going to be led by graduate students Adrian Tyree from History, next to Allison Kaledzi, also historian. And let's see, do I see my other leader? No. Jessica Kane from English. Great. Awesome. And I... So those are going to be our leaders, and we're going to be using discussion questions that you probably already have that were prepared by Dr. Jackson. I guess now I'll just say thank you to various library units that are helping us here tonight. Our Library Diversity Committee, Jill Morningstar is here, and she actually is our education librarian. And one of the things she does is she curates our children's literature collection, which focuses on diversity in children's literature. So might be of interest, and you can talk to Jill about that. And also thanks to our eight Digital Media Center, Mike, there, and thank you to our Muslim Studies program. I'm about to introduce, well, just right now, I'm introducing Professor Muhammad Khalil, who's the director of our Muslim Studies program. He's a professor in the Religious Studies Department and also teaches in the MSU College of Law, and there's more to say, but he's going to introduce our presenter.
Yeah. Well, good evening. Welcome to you all. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you. So I'm delighted to introduce our speaker for this evening. He's Professor Austin Jackson, and I'll be reading off my phone to save paper, hoping nobody calls. Professor Austin Jackson is a professor of rhetoric, writing, and African-American studies in the Residential College in the Arts and Humanities, ARCA, at Michigan State. Before coming to the ARCA, Austin taught in the Tier 1 writing program in MSU's James Madison College. He also serves as director of the My Brothers and Sisters Keepers program, a mentoring and service learning program for adolescent youth attending Detroit public schools. More recently, he established My Brothers Keeper Prison Outreach Program, a peer mentoring program for inmates at the Richard A. Handlin Correctional Facility in Ionia. Austin's research and teaching areas include rhetoric and writing, African American language and literacy, and qualitative research methods in English education. His research and publications examine how African-American language and culture, especially rap music and hip-hop culture, can facilitate meaningful student engagement in social democracy. Austin is a core faculty member in the African-American and African Studies program and the Muslim Studies program here at Michigan State. In addition, Austin advises and helps organize numerous campus student organizations devoted to issues of racial, social, and economic justice. And today he'll be discussing the autobiography of Malcolm X with Alex Haley, which is a book that has really influenced many Muslim Americans or American Muslims. In fact, I would argue that it's the most influential book by a Muslim in America. And I know for me personally, it was the first full-length, the first book that I read on Islam or Muslims. And I remember I was a middle schooler reading the book, in the library of our mosque, and another Muslim said, well, why are you reading this and not some other book? And I said, this is the one I want to read. So anyway, with that, please join me in welcoming Professor Austin Jackson.
All right, good evening. Assalamu alaikum. First, I want to correct something. I'm not going to lecture. It's late, so I'll pretty much be speaking from the heart with a couple of visual aids. So the late historian Manny Marble, in his magnum opus before he passed away in 2012, he wrote this sort of tome called Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. And it was the first significant comprehensive treatment of Malcolm X since the autobiography of Malcolm X was written by Alex Haley. It's significant, and I highly recommend it, because one of the things that Manny Marble does is that he looks at some of the gaps in the original text, some of the fissures, some of the incongruities that hopefully, through some of the questions that I tried to develop with the help of Muhammad and Deborah, I hope that we can really get into. I'm trained in English, and I had this professor of Chaucer who said he believed in a long, slow, painful explication of a text. So hopefully that part, and Chaucer was quite painful. I dropped it 3 times. But hopefully that won't be painful. In fact, I think that that's the most significant thing, because you've all read the book, or you've encountered Malcolm X in some other kind of way. You've seen Spike Lee's autobiography. So there's no need for me to stand here and lecture about the content of the book itself. There's something in there for everyone, for the most part. So what I want to do is look at, I think that what's not in a text or what's ambiguous in a text is just as significant about what's actually in it. So that's what I want to get into. What I want to do is actually step outside the text in the first part of what I have to say here. First, with a little bit of a background about why I find this interesting and why I believe that this book is transformative, has been transformative for so many people. Brother Muhammad just said, it's really and truly the most significant text by a Muslim author in America, if not the world. Many of us, such as myself, we came to know Islam initially through reading the autobiography of Malcolm X. But I want to go a little bit further, and I actually want to tell you something that I've never actually told anyone before, that my encounter with Malcolm X, it actually saved my life. I encountered Malcolm X in 1988, upstate New York. What is happening in 1988? What's the context of 1988? Well, we have a few things going on that's pretty significant to impact all of us that were alive at the time, but especially people like me, poor, urban, African-American kid in upstate New York. We have the Reagan-era recession happening at this time. The economic situation is pretty tough. And in places like mine in central upstate New York, the factories had long closed and went to Mexico or the southern United States. So there was no work, a lot of hopelessness and despair. At the same time, we had the AIDS epidemic happening. And not only just the AIDS epidemic, but the government's poor response to the AIDS epidemic. Many people in my community were losing their lives, not just because of this scourge, but because we had a government in place at the time that said that if you were gay, if you were lesbian, if you had HIV, if you were HIV positive, if you had AIDS, that essentially you were immoral and you did not deserve government services. So there wasn't very much help during the Reagan years and Bush years for those people, and many people in my community lost their lives because of it. We had the crack cocaine epidemic at the same time. And it's not enough just simply to say the crack cocaine epidemic. We have to describe what was happening in the 80s as a all-out drug war. It turned many inner cities like Detroit and my little hometown in upstate New York and places like Los Angeles, all over the country, it turned them into virtual war zones. No, literally war zones. And that's the situation in which I grew up in. My parents succumbed to the crack cocaine epidemic. At 15 years old, both of my parents were addicted to crack cocaine, and I had younger siblings that I had to care for. So that was the context in which I ran into Malcolm X. At that time, I didn't really see too much hope. I didn't have the wisdom of my ancestors. There was no grandma, grandpa to help. It was just day-to-day survival, trying to go to school, take care of my younger siblings, trying not to fall in the throes of the crack epidemic, but sometimes having just to survive, having to sell drugs just to get over, just to make sure that these kids had food to eat. And we were living in this flat, and there was no furniture, only a set of books that my parents carried around in this box. So I started rummaging through this book, like, what is this? And my mother did attend college for a couple semesters at SUNY Albany. So I opened it up, and I found H. Rapp Brown, I found Soledad Brother, I found all this black revolutionary literature, and then I found this. And at a time in which I actually was considering, say, you know what, I'm tired of struggling. You know, I might as well just go ahead and just do what everybody else is doing. Or maybe I should even just end my life, you know? This book literally saved my life. I sat down, and in two nights, I read it from cover to cover. And by the end, even though I really didn't know what a Muslim was, I knew I was that, by the end of it. And I knew that my worldview had been opened, that this gave me a framework for understanding the world in which I live. So Malcolm X's story, his life of reinvention, moving from Malcolm Little to Detroit Red, really it should be Lansing Red, because he grew up around here, but nobody's ever heard of Lansing outside of Lansing, so Detroit Red. And Satan when he was in prison, eventually Minister Malcolm X, and then after the Hajj, taking the name El Hajj Malik al-Shabazz, that I understood that there was change was in fact possible. So, but it also helped me understand race and class and all kinds of things that I didn't understand at that time. So when we talk about the significance, why is the autobiography of Malcolm X important? I want to situate our conversation in these lines, because this autobiography, for many people, they save lives. As Brother Muhammad just said, one of the things I do is I teach in prisons. I just established a prison outreach program in Ionia, Michigan. And many of the inmates tell me that, from either being on drugs or selling drugs, when they encountered this book, it really had a transformative impact on them in many different ways. So with that sort of dramatic sort of context, I think it's important, because why? It's really easy to focus on this book as a sort of lesson in American individualism, to read this as a sort of Horatio Alger myth, that, hey, look, change is possible. Look at Malcolm X. He lifted himself up by the bootstraps, and he was able to do it, so can you. So, and then just totally omit all the critique that he had of American democracy and institutionalized racism, okay? So what I want to do, and I know that I'm supposed to be mostly talking, but I want to hear a little bit of Malcolm X's voice. I want to insert that into the conversation. So I'm going to play just a few minutes of this documentary, PBS's Malcolm X, Make It Plain. And then from there, I want to expound upon what I just talked about in terms of the impact of Malcolm X on the hip-hop generation. And when I say the hip-hop generation, don't be scared. I'm not going to expose you to any harsh music that might offend you. But I will certainly say that when I say the hip-hop generation, I'm talking about those of us that were born after this sort of, what's the legal term? You're a lawyer kind of a guy. De jure forms of legalized segregation were done away with after the 1960s. That generation that came of age in the early 70s, or were born in the early 70s, that's what I'm referring to as the hip-hop generation, okay? So with that, let's just play a little bit of Make It Plain.
Of your hair? Who taught you to hate the shape of your nose and the shape of your lips? Who taught you to hate yourself from the top of your head to the soles of your feet? Who taught you to hate your own kind? Who taught you to hate the race that you belong to? So much so that you don't want to be around each other. No, before you come asking Mr. Muhammad, does he teach hate? You should ask yourself, who taught you to hate being what God gave you?
Most of us blacks, or Negroes as he called us, really thought we were free without being aware that in our subconscious, all those chains we thought had been struck off were still there. And there were many ways where what really motivated us was our desire to be loved by the white man. Malcolm meant to lance that sense of inferiority. He knew it would be painful. He knew that people could kill you because of it, but he dared to take that risk.
He was saying something over and above that of any other leader of that day. While the other leaders were begging for entry into the house of their oppressor, he was telling you to build your own house.
He expelled fear for African Americans. He says, I will speak out loud what we've been thinking. And he said, you'll see, people will hear it and they will not do anything to us necessarily, okay? But I will now speak it for the masses of people. When he said it in a very strong fashion, in this very manly fashion, in this fashion that says, I am not afraid to say what you've been thinking all these years, that's why we loved him. He said it out loud, not behind closed doors. He took on America for us.
And I, for one, as a Muslim, believe that the white man is intelligent enough. If he were made to realize how black people really feel and how fed up we are without that old compromise and sweet talk, why, you're the one that make it hard for yourself. The white man believes you when you go to him with that old sweet talk. Because you've been sweet-talking him ever since he brought you here. Stop sweet-talking him. Tell him how you feel. Tell him how what kind of hell you've been catching. And let him know that if he's not ready to clean his house up, if he's not ready to clean his house up, he shouldn't have a house. It should catch on fire and burn down.
So that this presentation of Malcolm X represents a particular Malcolm X. It doesn't represent the Malcolm X post-Hajj. It doesn't represent Malcolm X as a street hustler, but this is Minister Malcolm, the fiery Malcolm X willing to speak truth to power directly to the white man's face. The implicit threat of violence always there. Oftentimes, people contrast Malcolm X with Martin Luther King Jr. That's the reason why I feel like this image here, found in Lansing, Malcolm X's hometown, is really interesting. Anybody ever been to this corner here? Yeah. What's ironic about it, it was probably one of the most dangerous fucking corners there is in Lansing. The corner of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, and there's a gas station there. The Malcolm X Street came to fruition, you know, a few years ago, by at the very long, hard work of this group called the Malcolm X Foundation. And in every urban city, you'll find a Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. And the MLK Boulevard is usually, I don't know, pretty much a commercial street and kind of dangerous for the most part, ironically. So, but I really love this image of this intersection because we oftentimes say that these two figures are opposed to each other. Martin Luther King Jr., this paragon of peace, Malcolm X, this proponent of violence. But in actuality, when you look at what these men actually did before both of them were assassinated, it's really the opposite. Malcolm X was never associated with any violence. That's attested in you've read the autobiography. Everything he said after he left the Nation of Islam, he never advocated a coup d'etat or violent overthrow of government. So Malcolm X is pretty much a speaker. He's a rhetorician. But his words have this sort of power to it that scared the hell out of people at that time period. King, who we normally associate with peace, was actually the violent agitator. If you really think about it, I see some surprised looks on your faces. How could King be the agitator? Well, what did King do when he was alive? King intentionally went down south, said that I'm going to march across this bridge. We're going to keep on moving and sing these songs, even though police with dogs would say, you cannot cross this bridge. If you move, we're going to attack you. You will be beaten down and arrested. And King knew that, his followers knew that, and that's what King did. He actually provoked violence intentionally so it could be captured on film and then used as a tool to show how violent and how vicious Southern segregation was. So from the onset, that's something that we have to do, is stop comparing these two as if though they're oppositional to one another. Because in reality, Malcolm X was never really associated with any acts of violence. King, you can't really say that. But the title of this particular presentation is called Ballots or Bullets. Malcolm X gave a famous speech that essentially said that unless you make access to the ballot accessible, then you might end up getting bullets. In other words, people are willing to do whatever it takes to be free, even if it means reserving the right to self-defense and violent revolution, if possible, okay? During the Arab Spring, it was really interesting because I hadn't realized the impact that Malcolm X had on the overseas Muslim population. Malcolm X's name was brought up in rap lyrics, and even with some of the styles, you can see that it mimics a lot of African-American styles of dress. I think that one of the things that is missing, one of the gaps in this book, is that there's no mention of Malcolm X's political program that might resonate overseas. And there's no description, really. There's passing mention of the Organization of African-American Unity, or Muslim Mosque Incorporated. And a lot of people have speculated that the reason why you don't really have that detailed description of Malcolm X's political program, what he actually wanted to see happen, is because the person who wrote this book, As Told to Alex Haley, the sort of subtitle here, was actually an integrationist. He was conservative. Alex Haley actually started writing Malcolm X and interviewing Malcolm X because he despised Malcolm X. He wanted to discredit Malcolm X's ideas about this sort of like radical racial separation, for the most part. So we don't really hear about Malcolm X other than just the fiery firebrand that you see there. But Malcolm X did have a comprehensive political program, and one of those things that he focused on was human rights. So let's see if I can play this. I'm sorry if this audio is not the best.
African heads of state that there are 22 million of us in America who are also of African descent. And to remind them also that we are the victims of America's colonialism or American imperialism, and that our problem is not an American problem, it's a human problem. It's not a Negro problem, it's a problem of humanity. It's not a problem of civil rights, but a problem of human rights.
So the problem is not a problem that can be captured with civil rights. That's what the mainstream civil rights organizations were fighting for. That's what King was fighting for. He said that this was a problem of human rights. And I'm not going to read this long paragraph here, but essentially the reason why Malcolm X sought to focus on human rights is because he recognized that American democracy was what he called American hypocrisy. I know that sounds harsh, but for the African American, American democracy has always been sort of hypocritical. During the Africans first came here as immigrants, we didn't come here freely. We came here in 1619 against our will, in chains, as slaves. And even after the Declaration of Independence said that all men are created equal, Africans were obviously left, and women were left out of that famous declaration. Even after the Constitution was ratified, still African Americans were defined as three-fifths human beings. So I think that we can forgive Malcolm and African Americans in general when we point out the fact that American democracy has always been, excuse me if I'm mispronouncing this word, I don't speak German, but has always been a Herrenvolk democracy. It's been a democracy for white people. It hasn't been a democracy for people of color, and in this case, African Americans. And we're still fighting against that hypocritical definition of democracy. So when it comes to civil rights are those rights that civil society gives you, the laws, the courts. Human rights are those rights that you have just by virtue of the fact that you are a human being. So Malcolm X saw that human rights, were that's where the struggle lies, because the civil rights struggle, he didn't believe would be successful. How can we have civil rights when the white folks who control our government don't even believe that black people are actually full human beings? So I'm gonna not talk about this in detail, the impact on Occupy Wall Street and other movements, but one of the most controversial things, or people consider controversial, is Malcolm X's stance on violence or nonviolence, and it's captured in his motto, by any means necessary.
Tonight, Front Page Challenge welcomes the outspoken Negro leader, Malcolm X.
Sir, what's the real reason why you two men split? Is it merely ideological or is it personality? What else?
Probably personality. It was not the statement that originally was given by the movement when we split. More personality than anything else.
You've called people like Martin Luther King, who just got a Nobel Peace Prize, an Uncle Tom. Is this correct, first?
Well, I'd rather say that in the States, there's a law that has recently been passed, or a decision handed down by the court, wherein if you call someone an Uncle Tom, they can sue you for libel.
Well,
so I never refer to them as Uncle Tom's. I would say that Uncle Martin is my friend.
Uncle Martin is your friend, yet you would disagree with his approach to what he wants to accomplish.
Definitely. If his approach would bring about what the black man in America needs to completely eliminate the problem that we have, I would say well and good. But I very much doubt that anyone who adopts the approach that Martin Luther King has been teaching to our people in that country can point to any meaningful gains that has actually served to solve the problem.
Black Muslims have sometimes, whether you have or not, and I think probably you have sometimes, it seemed to me, been preaching hate to meet hate.
I don't advocate any kind of hate.
But there's a lot of talk that sounds very much like it.
No, I think that the guilt complex of the American white man is so profound until when you begin to analyze the real condition of the black man in America, instead of the American white man eliminating the causes that create that condition, he tries to cover it up by accusing his accusers of teaching hate. But actually, they're just exposing him for being responsible for what exists.
Well, that's something of an argument. But I've heard speeches made by some of the people of your group. I think I've heard you make speeches. It seemed to me that you were advocating what I would have to describe, I think, as violence to meet the serious injuries that have been done your people, with which I totally agree.
I don't call that violence. I don't in any way encourage black people to go out and initiate acts of aggression indiscriminately against whites. But I do believe that the black man in the United States, and any human being anywhere, is well within his right to do whatever is necessary, by any means necessary, to protect his life and property, especially in a country where the federal government itself has proven that it is either unable or unwilling to protect the lives and property of those human beings.
Just before Pierre takes it, you've got a pretty good fighter and the world's heavyweight champion lined up with you to help out. Yes, Pierre.
Well, Mr. X, if I guess I call you that. Is that a proper appellation?
Yes.
Mr. X? I'm wondering if you still believe, as I think you certainly did at the time you were allied to the black Muslim movement, in a segregated black nation
no.
in North America.
I don't believe in any form of segregation or any form of racism. I'm against any form of segregation and against racism.
Am I right in saying that the black Muslim movement, which you have left, did believe in that?
Well, Elijah Muhammad taught his followers that the only solution was a separate state
yeah.
for black people. And as long as I thought he genuinely believed that himself, I believed in him and believed in his solution. But when I began to doubt that he himself believed that that was feasible, and I saw no kind of action designed to bring it into existence or bring it about, then I turned in a different direction.
So the major thing that I wanted to capture there is that Malcolm X is simply asserting the First Amendment right for people to simply defend themselves. And it's oftentimes the case that whenever African Americans talk about bearing arms, protecting their lives, that makes folks feel uncomfortable. the image of King and some of our folks in Congress right now, like Representative John Lewis. We admire them. We admire their bravery for taking the fire hose, getting bit by dogs, getting beaten down by police, and not striking back. So they deserve certainly our respect. At the same time, do we apply the First Amendment selectively, or is this only the providence of white people? Do black people have the right to defend themselves, to assert that same right? Should black people, when being attacked, do everything they can to protect their life, or should they, on matter of, just as a matter of principle, not resort to violence and allow their lives to be taken? This is a very, very uncomfortable topic to bring up, but I think it's essential, especially now in the context of these extrajudicial police shootings of black people. So far, most, despite what you hear on Fox News, if you listen to that sort of stuff, everything has been peaceful. Everything has been peaceful. The marches have been peaceful. What we've seen actually is actually more police aggression. We've seen police riot, as in Ferguson, provoke violence against peaceful protesters and attack them for simply demonstrating their First Amendment right for peaceful assembly. So that's something that doesn't really appear very much in the autobiography of Malcolm X. This strange image here. Well, first let me explain the image on the left. As you know from reading the text, Malcolm X left the Nation of Islam after some hypocrisy and some contradictions were revealed about Elijah Muhammad and the nature of the Nation of Islam. He began to see that the Nation of Islam was not just a religious organization intent on protecting black people. Essentially, the Nation of Islam was a criminal organization, and he wanted no part of that as a moral person. The Nation of Islam, as a sort of criminal enterprise with a lot of people who in it willing to commit crimes in order to protect the reputation of the organization, they firebombed his house and attempted to kill his kids in Queens, New York. So the image that was snapped here is with Malcolm X with a M1 carbine rifle, and he's looking out the window on guard, looking to see if his house is going to be attacked by the Nation. This guy here, his real name is Christopher Parker, grew up kind of like I did, except in the Bronx, New York, homeless, in the middle of the crack cocaine epidemic, and in order to resist the lure of drugs, he began to like rap and engage in the culture of the time period. At a party in the South Bronx, one of his best friends, who was also a social worker, was killed in an act of random violence over a girl. And it occurred to Chris Parker that he had to do something to use his music, use his art in the ways that most African Americans have always used their art, using their art in order to educate people, to enlighten, to uplift, using his art, this hip hop, in order to change the world in which he lived in. So during the 1980s, we really owe the reemergence of Malcolm X after being lost during the 1970s. No one was talking about Malcolm X during that time period. But in the midst of the crack cocaine epidemic, as I mentioned, many of our parents, many of our elders, many of them were incapacitated because of the drug epidemic and other situations. So the hip hop generation of that time period, people my age and a little bit older, they said that we had to do something desperate. We had to find where the wisdom of our ancestors were. So believe it or not, these young, barely literate African Americans went on a literate search and they found Malcolm X and they created discussion groups and reading circles right there in the hood. I know because I was part of some of those things. We didn't know what some of the words meant. We had to use a dictionary to figure it out and look up references. But we did. So hip hop became something that was used as a political tool. So as I said, I won't play a lot of the hip hop right now, but one of the things that I think is important, the theorist Terry Eagleton says, I think is relevant. He says that oppressed groups or classes, women, the proletariat, ethnic minorities, and colonized people use culture to engage in structural theorizing so they can be in effective possession of themselves and grasp something of their own material location within a wider system of realizing their highly specific interest in emancipation. Likewise, one of my mentors, a retired professor here, Geneva Smitherman, she says that rappers are postmodern African griots who aim to speak the truth, not only of past conditions, but to testify to today's struggle in the African diaspora to overcome racism and oppression. So whenever you look at hip hop during that time period, Malcolm X figures widely. So what does this have to do with the autobiography of Malcolm X? And why is this relevant today? Well, I think that if Malcolm X's message of like personal uplift is to continue into this millennium, one of the things that we have to do is go deeper and not just simply accept Haley's biography, which we all appreciate, as this sort of myth of the individual who just simply has the personal fortitude to uplift himself. And we have to begin to ask critical questions of this book. Where is Malcolm X's political program? As we know, Alex Haley's political philosophy was actually opposed to Malcolm X's. What are the textual implications behind that? So what I did is that I created some questions that hopefully will allow us to dive into those things. So if you don't mind, could you put those in front of you real quick? Everybody have a copy? Actually, let me get a paper copy myself. Yes, I'm not looking at my laptop. Thank you. So here are some of the questions that I'd like for us to explore. The autobiography of Malcolm X, as told to Alex Haley, immediately raises the classic Socratic problem. Who and where is the author in this text? Just as we know the teachings of Socrates through Plato, readers know Malcolm X, who was an outspoken black nationalist, through Alex Haley, a self-described integrationist. What gaps, fissures, disparities in tone, silences, and other textual elements might provide insight into this problem? The second question, some critics argue that Haley's work misrepresents Malcolm X as a Horatio Alger myth. They contend that the autobiography promotes a conservative idea that deeply rooted structural inequality can be overcome by the rugged individual, simply lifting himself up by his own bootstraps. What organizational structures, points of views, themes, topics, and so on in the text might support such a reading? Reflecting upon his time in the Norfolk prison colony, Malcolm said that many who today hear me somewhere in person or on television, or those who read something I've said, will think I went to school far beyond the eighth grade. This impression is due entirely to my prison studies. What definition of literacy and education emerges from the autobiography of Malcolm X? 4, what portrait of Lansing, Michigan appears in the autobiography? And how did this backdrop impact Malcolm X's early worldview? How does Islam and its various expressions and forms become meaningful within the African-American community? 6, the late historian and biographer Manny Marble titled his magnum opus, Malcolm X, The Life of Reinvention. How did Malcolm reinvent himself and why? And then the last question, within the African-American literary tradition of using personal story as a political commentary, how might we read the autobiography of Malcolm X as a slave within the slave narrative tradition, organization, structure, major themes, and rhetorical choices? It's also important to note that Malcolm X was assassinated before this book was published. He was assassinated on February 21st, 1965. I believe that the book was published later that year, so his input was not there. Another thing that's not in the text as well, and this is sort of, I don't know, kind of ghoulish in my opinion. There are 3 chapters of this text that we know exist, that we know are not in the book. They were sold at an auction, at like a Sotheby's auction, and there's a gentleman, a lawyer, I can't call him a gentleman, he's kind of ghoulish. There's an African-American businessman in Detroit who actually has these 3 chapters. They're in a safe, and he won't release them to the general public for reasons that I think they're only financial. In 2011, we had a big Malcolm X conference here sponsored by the African-American Studies Program. We invited Mr. Reed to come and talk, and he did. He showed up. He was very polite, very generous with his time. But essentially, he said that he's holding out for the highest bidder before he releases these chapters. And it was the contention of the late Manny Marble and many other scholars of Malcolm that these missing chapters actually contain Malcolm X's vision for a detailed program, okay? A detailed program that wasn't just about organizing Muslims, although he thought that was important. What I personally find significant about Malcolm X's, what we know in his latter speeches, is that he believed in a strict separation of church and state. And as a Muslim, I found that very, very interesting and something that Muslims themselves need to, I think should actually revisit. You know, what role should religion play in our public life? As an American, I kind of accept that, you know, separation of church and state, you know, religion and the state. But for Muslim countries trying to find the balance between modernity and, you know, staying true to Islam, I think that's something that should be certainly talked about a lot. So with that, how should we do this? Okay, sounds like we had some pretty intense, very insightful discussion. I'd like to avoid just kind of going down in a linear fashion to each question. Is there anything that anyone would just like to share for the next like 5-10 minutes? Anything that you found, any line of conversation that you found interesting or illuminating about the text or about race relations, society, something that you found interesting? Let's just kind of keep it informal. Anyone want to start off?
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, certainly. And you can ask questions. To me or the entire group, yes.
What stood out to you about the book when you were reading it the first time? What like two or three things?
The first one, honestly, was just the visual. Looking at the text, seeing a man who seemed to be very intense and deep thought. The fact that, just the iconography, the visual rhetoric of the text itself was the thing that caught my eye. It made me read this book versus other books that was in this sort of mysterious box that my mother was carrying around. The fact that his last name was an X intrigued me. Like, why is his last name an X? And then I learned early on, and as we talked about it in some of the discussion groups, the importance of naming. Language defines your thought, or language is thought. So the Nation of Islam, obviously, sought to lance African-Americans of their slave identity. And that meant getting rid of what they refer to as the slave name and replacing it with an X, X in mathematics, representing the unknown. Because we really don't know, because our religion, culture, our tribes, all that information has been really done away with for the most part. So that's the first thing that caught my attention. The fact that a black man wrote it, it was the first time that I was reading a text that was written by someone of African descent. And just the frankness that in which he spoke, the truth of it, it just resonated with me. And with every chapter, I began to see something about the world in which I was living in New York at that time period that made a lot of sense to me. It also allowed me to make sense of, believe it or not, this might sound silly, but it was important because popular culture is how most of us, most cats don't read, you know? I mean, we're in college, so we have the luxury of reading, but most working people don't have time, you know, to sit down and really read academic text. So a lot of what we learn kind of through osmosis, through popular culture, just whatever's being said on the TV screen and stuff like that. So I was hearing these references that I didn't in hip hop and other forms of popular culture. And it was only when I started reading Malcolm X that I was like, okay, that's what that means. Okay, this song mentioned Timbuktu. And now he's talking about Timbuktu. What's Timbuktu? What's that? Oh, an ancient Muslim African, you know, kingdom that had one of the oldest libraries and universities in the world. So it just helped me make sense of so much that was going on in my world. But the first thing was just simply the cover itself. In fact, I had a different color cover. He was actually pointing. You know, I'm like, what is he pointing at? This man has something to say. So thank you for the question. All right. Anyone would like to share anything from your groups? Yes.
I just remembered that this morning I was searching up my last, like his real, what they called him, his last name was Little, or the one that was given to him. He hid it. The people were asking, what were you called? And he would not, he would hide it. He actually hid it. He said that it's X for no one knows.
Yes, absolutely. It was Malcolm X's really authentic response in that interview. The interviewer kept asking him, well, what is your last name? And he said that, well, my last name is X. Well, what is your real name? And Malcolm X said that it's X, it's Malcolm X. And he said that, well, is that your real name? He said, as far as I'm concerned, it's my real name. That's what I call myself. So essentially, the reporter was trying to bait Malcolm, you know, to acknowledge his slave name. So often, reporters were not always objective, I guess. They would try to bait Malcolm, get him to say something that was against his interest. But at that time period, and I think that for the most part throughout Malcolm's life, he remained steadfast about that history, about that name being the name, the last name, Little, of the people that owned your family. And I'm not sure those of you that are not African Americans can really appreciate that, that not only do you experience the indignity of being enslaved, but you have to carry around the name of the person who enslaved you. It's pretty significant. So I think that we can sort of understand why Malcolm would not acknowledge that slave name, you know, whatsoever. We know it only because it had to be published in the book. So excellent. Yes, sir.
I feel like, isn't that a big deal with Muhammad Ali? The people refused to call him by his chosen.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Muhammad Ali, same thing. When he joined the Nation of Islam, as tradition, he didn't take the X. He was given, I guess, a special name because Elijah Muhammad wanted to make sure he was in the fold as a famous guy, and named him Muhammad Ali. There was a guy, I forgot which boxer it was, that tried to like get into Muhammad Ali's head, and Sonny Liston. Was it Sonny Liston? That intentionally called him Cassius Clay, and he beat him within an inch of his life. In fact, there's footage, I mean, it's brutal, but he's like, you know, what's my name? What's my name? As he's like beating him, you know. So yeah, they took that pretty seriously. Yes, sir.
Just want to make a comment that besides us being here at State, we both are ex-military, U.S. Marine and service. But the first book I read, Crossing the Atlantic, was the autobiography of Malcolm X. Great book, man. Changed my whole perspective at 20.
Okay.
Yeah,
both of us were in the military, served on United States submarines. Kind of like being in prison in some ways, because you can't escape.
Right.
So I was 2,000 feet underneath the water during my time in the military. And the first book I read, it was Alice Walker's Possessing the Secret of Joy. Why that was on the submarine, I have no idea. You know, but I'm like, I'll take it, anything. Yes. Okay. All right, other things. There were some really good conversations. Come on, folks. Yes.
One of the things that came up in my group was talking about prison as that sort of turning point for his life.
Yes.
That he gives us a really very classic redemption narrative of like, I was very bad, let me tell you about all my time in the street. And then he goes to prison, he starts to read and to learn, and then he gets, like, his brother says, like, you know, like, stop eating pork, stop smoking, we'll talk about why later, essentially. And he goes through that transition period, and then Lila made the comment of like, then when he gets out of prison, he goes to his brother's house, he notices how much the sort of structure of the Nation of Islam, even at the family level, exists there. And so like the difference between his pre-prison, very chaotic life, to prison in its own kind of regimented world, but externally regimented, to then, even the family level, a more sort of controlled, ritualized, regimented world, even at the family level, that their faith provided them was.
And what do you make of this? Like, what's significant about it?
I thought it was interesting because it was like there was a switch from an externally prescribed kind of regiment to a more internal one, that the family chose to take on these particular rituals and practices together, and so where it seemed like Malcolm previously really resisted any kind of structure, you know, mm-hmm. he was really very successful as a hustler, very successful kind of in his previous life, and then with that conversion, with that transition. You certainly.
So I guess the thing I'd like us to consider when you talk about that order is that in the film version of Malcolm X by Spike Lee, it makes it seem as if though Malcolm didn't have certain things. Like, for example, it presents Malcolm as being like illiterate before he goes to prison. One of the things that Spike Lee, I think, in my opinion, I love that movie, by the way, that could have done better is showing connections between his early life. For example, the Garvey, this Garvey household was ran almost like a military. It was very ordered. In fact, he talks about in the book that, you know, once my father died, we got sort of, we ran amok. My mother couldn't run fast enough to catch us and stuff like that. That discipline wasn't there. So it was that. So the seeds were always planted. That's why it's important. I kind of go back and forth because Muhammad had a great point, you know, that this guy is really extraordinary. Anything he decided to put his mind to, he excelled at it, whether it be like shooting dice or hustling, selling drugs, or, you know, creating Nation of Islam temples all over. Whatever he did, he excelled at it. So clearly, this is an exceptional human being, okay? So, you know, so I feel kind of conflicted because I want to avoid the sort of like heroic myth about Malcolm X. But, you know, he's incredible, you know? Who knows if the English teacher didn't discourage him, who knows what kind of lawyer or organizer or politician that he could have been. So, absolutely. But one of the things that we have to remember is that the seeds were planted by these early things. The Garveyite culture in the household, which I neglected to talk about, you know, the discipline, the sort of like paramilitary type structure that the United Negro Improvement Association operated in, and how that helped shape things like family structure. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And in the book, he also talked about he was number one in his class. He was a class president. So from like his childhood, he was already excelling. So that probably helped.
Right, absolutely. And it's exceptional. I mean, you know, considering that his father was killed, he's in an orphanage, but yet he's excelling. So it's I heard some other groups talk about how it's so important to not like write kids off. I think that's why all of us probably feel a little bit of pain right now about the state of public education and fear of like where it's gonna go. Because even the poorest kid, we have to give them the same type of nurturing and attention because you never know what kind of remarkable individual we could be writing off. So, yeah, absolutely. Yes?
I recently just read The Color Purple by Alice Walker, which I was kind of impressed that you just mentioned it. I wasn't going to say anything about it, but I saw a lot of similarities in her story, especially at the beginning, with the mother slowly going insane. The father had been executed. I'm going to use the word executed, but killed, murdered, and then the family is raised in a very typical, difficult environment. But I mention it just because I saw some overlap there, where tonight we've been talking a lot about different books, different movies, different lives that have come into play. Spike Lee, Alice Walker, Malcolm X, Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, all of these different individuals, and it's so relevant in our lives today. It's a foundation of our fabric that we have in our society today. And we were talking about how, you know, which of the two books that we've discussed so far this past semester do we like? And we like them both in general, but I think a lot of us are really connecting with this one because it is part of our foundation of our society today. And so I want to thank you for leading this conversation and for sharing insight on how the fabric relates so heavily in our lives today.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, you all revealed things I never really thought about before. Even in your comments, it made me think about the role that the state played going after Malcolm's family. You know, the mother, you know, went insane, and it's true that she did go insane, but she went insane as the state targeted that Garvey household. I don't know what role the state played in terms of the actual murder, but the denial of insurance, that seemed to be pretty intentional. Taking away the kids out of that household and then sending them up, it seems to be a very clear state goal to disrupt the family structure. And that's what you're alluding to in Alice Walker's The Color Purple. The trauma is because of the breakup of the family. And if Malcolm X reflects a slave narrative, then we have to pay attention to family structures, whether it be how the family's organized and how the family's disrupted and why. Slavery was a very traumatic, not just because people were placed and changed and whipped and made to work for free, was because it was traumatic in the sense that family structures were disrupted. Babies were just sold, you know, and stripped out of their mother's arms. And many people that actually look like me, like Frederick Douglass, for example, who's in the news a lot. Frederick Douglass lives. Thank you, Donald Trump. Frederick Douglass's father was the slave master who raped the enslaved African. So Frederick Douglass, like Barack Obama, is half white, but because of the one drop rule, he sold into slavery. So in terms of like family structure, it's a thing that's disrupted, and it's one of the things that the African-American community, doesn't matter Nation of Islam or whatever, truly values. Well, all of us value family. But yeah, the trauma really starts on the family level.
Well, there's a, I was glancing through a recent book, and I'm sorry I don't remember the title, but it had to do with the African-Americans getting pulled into the prison system in today's society, how terrible we have been in terms of not protecting getting into the prison, and we are stealing, in many respects, their civil rights in a very different way. You don't let them vote because now they have felonies.
Yes, and made to work for free. Yes.
The new Jim Crow, thank you. That's the name of the book. Yeah.
Yes, the new Jim Crow. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a movie called The 13th that you could actually watch and get like the visual version of that. We'll take one more question, but let me just mention this on a more positive note. I don't want to say more positive, but something that is reaffirming. I love the conversation that all the groups had about education and expanding our conception of education beyond just the walls of the schoolroom. Malcolm X deliberately mentioned his prison education being the most empowering to him. So if we're thinking about what we can do to help, then we should think about both informal, formal and informal forms of education. For example, I teach at a prison. And the reason why I'm at that prison, the Richard A. Hanlon facility in Ionia, is because the prisoners wrote me here on this campus and said, can you come here? You know, can you come set up a peer mentoring program? Could we have a prisoner-led My Brother's Keeper? Could we have a Muslim, could we have Islamic studies? Calvin College is there, but they don't offer, just because they don't have the personnel, Islamic studies. So, you know, in conversations about, well, how could we make that happen? Help me, brother. So I think that we have to think about what we can do is that we can do things like, for example, help those guys, you know, send them books, you know, write to them, give them hope. And in Lansing, I mentioned that there's the El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz Academy, which is a charter school. And in Detroit, there's the Malcolm X Academy, which actually has the sanctioning of Malcolm X's family officially and does outstanding work. So, yeah, there are some things that we can do. Maybe we have time for maybe one more question, comment, insight. Yes. Absolutely, and apply that to this larger Islamic concept, you know, the idea of Ummah, even when he went overseas. And this, again, is one of the major fissures or absences in this text that a lot of people find kind of questionable, that the fact that he was the guest of Prince or King Faisal, the fact that Malcolm had a reputation, a very positive reputation overseas in the Middle East, in West Africa, that he was a guest of state, you know, in all these different countries and was traveling and talking about the plight of African Americans and really trying to learn more about, you know, about Islam, Sunni Islam, so which Malcolm felt was not necessarily a sort of cure-all, but certainly for many African Americans looking for some kind of like spiritual grounding, that he saw some form of liberation, you know, in Islam as practiced by millions of Muslims around the world. So and people saw this in this documentary. One of the princes says that I expected the fire breather. I expected this guy to come here and, you know, be like this like dragon-like figure, what have you. But he was actually quite shy and just had a very humble message, you know, and he just wanted to bring people together and educate folks. And that's what he wanted to do. So yeah, family structures for sure, but other people had Malcolm X's back as well. So yeah, anything else? Any other comments?
No, thank you.
Mm-hmm.